Through December and into the turn of the year, the On Being blog is offering a lovely series of seasonal reflections. Check in often to enjoy a nuanced and eclectic range of wisdom from our contributing writers. And we're collecting them all at onbeing.org/seasonalreflections.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation supports academic research and civil dialogue on the deepest, most perplexing questions facing humankind. Who are we? Why are we here? And where are we going? To learn more, please visit templeton.org. The Templeton Foundation. Stay curious.
Brother David Stendel Rost is a Benedictine monk and teacher, an author beloved around the world. Now in his 90s, he's lived through World War, the end of an empire, and the fascist takeover of his country. His TED Talk has been viewed millions of times on the subject of gratitude, a practice increasingly interrogated by scientists and physicians as a key to human well-being. And Brother David is a conversation partner in that emerging discovery. He was also an early pioneer, together with Thomas Merton, of dialogue between Christian and Buddhist monastics. He sees mysticism as the birthright of every human being. And his anatomy of gratitude is full-blooded, reality-based, and redeeming.
I don't speak of the gift, because not for everything that's given to you can you really be grateful. You can't be grateful for war in a given situation, or violence, or sickness, things like that. So the key, when people ask, can you be grateful for everything? No, not for everything, but in every moment.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Brother David Stendel Rost is founder and senior advisor for the Network for Grateful Living. He's also recently published an autobiography, I Am Through You, So I. I traveled to Austria in 2015 to speak with him at the monastery Gut Eich Priory in St. Gilgen, where he now spends most of each year. You were born Franz Kuno?
Yeah, that's right? Correct.
Here? In Vienna?
In Vienna, yeah. I'm very close to home again.
Yes. And here we are. How would you describe the religious and spiritual background of your childhood?
Of my childhood?
Yeah, of your childhood.
I think we had something at that time that was, I would call it Christendom, that doesn't exist
right,
anymore.
Right.
It was a kind of combination between the Christian tradition and all the social forms and customs. It was all one piece. Mm-hmm. And in my childhood, it was just breaking down. It was still strong enough to give me good support. And I like support. My mother always said, when I was a little baby, and I wasn't very tightly wrapped, as they used to wrap the babies. Very
swaddled,
tightly,
yeah.
I would yell. Only when I was very tightly wrapped that I felt comfortable. So this tight wrap of Christendom, where you knew exactly what to do, when, and how, that was very good for me.
Okay.
It was very congenial.
Yeah.
But it, as I say, it was already breaking down. There were already wounded from World War One. I remember either sitting by the street and begging, or in wheelchairs, the ones who were better off in wheelchairs. But they are a very important part of the population in my childhood, as I remember.
Mm.
But I'm grateful for the childhood I had. I had a warm and supportive family. And
then in it was in your teenage years that the world changed,
that really
so utterly
collapsed,
right?
Completely.
Right, and also interesting to me, I mean, Austria became an occupied country, it became a fascist country, and the church's role, the church's place in that very dramatic dynamic, because the church became almost a place of contrast to the culture, right? Which that's one way that Christendom, that monolithic Christendom was coming apart.
Yes. I see it since I was exactly 12 when when Hitler came. So that's, I entered my teens, and I spent all my teens under Hitler. And while at the first decade of my life was, so to say, an unquestioned world, then when you get into your teens, you have to rebel against right. that world. But instead, we rebelled against Hitler, because that was then the authority. So we were kind of pushed into resistance.
Yeah.
And it was very clear to us, and it was very strong. And the church was the support of it.
Well, I want to drill down and focus for the rest of our time on the notion of gratitude. But I think it's really important that we've kind of delved into the backdrop of your life and how you came to that, because there's depth and heft and gravitas. I mean, I think gratitude is one of these words culturally that can become superficial, right?
Can become,
and,
yeah.
But we're going to talk about spiritual gratitude and the depth of that. And one thing you do is you use the word gratefulness sometimes rather than gratitude. And I wonder if you would talk about what is helpful about that language for you of gratefulness at getting at kind of the gratitude as you understand it.
The reason why I use the words gratitude and gratefulness and thanksgiving in the way in which I use them is that we really need different terms for our experience. And we all know from experience that moments in which this gratitude wells up in our hearts are experienced first as if something were filling up within us, filling with joy, really, but not yet articulate. And then comes the point where the heart overflows, and we sing and we thank somebody, and for that I like a different term, and then I call that thanksgiving.
Okay.
And the two of them are two aspects, or two phases, actually, of the process that is gratitude. So that's why I'm using it in this way. And this idea of a vessel that is still inarticulate until it overflows, that is also very helpful in another way. It's like the bowl of a fountain when it fills up and it's very quiet and still, and then when it overflows, it starts to make noise and it sparkles and it ripples down.
Right.
And that is really when the joy comes to itself, so to say, when it is articulate. And for us, for many people in our culture, the heart fills up with joy, with gratefulness, and just at the moment when it wants to overflow and really the joy comes to itself, at that moment, advertisement comes in and says, no, there's a better model, and there's a newer model, and your neighbor has a bigger one. And and so instead of overflowing, we make the bowl bigger and bigger and bigger, and it never overflows. It never gives us this joy.
Yeah.
It's affluent, this affluent society. That means it always flows in. It doesn't overflow. It flows in and in and in and in and chokes us eventually.
Yeah.
And we don't have to deprive ourselves of anything, but we can learn that the real joy comes with quality, not with quantity.
Okay.
And that's an important distinction.
There are a few aspects or qualities of the experience of gratefulness and thanksgiving that you've noted that I'd love to just draw out. And one of them is beholding. That surprise can be a beginning of being grateful, and beholding and also listening. I mean, I guess what we're talking about here is attending.
Yeah. For me, this idea of listening and really looking and beholding, that comes in when people ask, well, how shall we practice this gratefulness?
Yes.
And there is a very simple kind of methodology to it. Stop, look, go. Most of us caught up in schedules and deadlines and rushing around. And so the first thing is that we have to stop, because otherwise we are not really coming into this present moment at all. We can't even appreciate the opportunity that is given to us, because we rush by and it rushes by. So stopping is the first thing. But that doesn't have to be long. When you are in practice, a split second is enough. You stop. And then you look, what is now the opportunity of this given moment, only this moment, and the unique opportunity of this moment. And that is where this beholding comes in. And if we really see what the opportunity is, we must, of course, not stop there, but we must do something with it. Go. Okay. Avail yourself of that opportunity. And if you do that, if you try practicing that at this moment, tonight, we will already be happier people, because it has an immediate feedback of joy. I always say I don't speak of the gift, because not for everything that's given to you can you really be grateful. You can't be grateful for war in a given situation, or violence, or domestic violence, or sickness, things like that. There are many things for which you cannot be grateful, but in every moment you can be grateful. For instance, the opportunity to learn something from a very different, difficult experience, mm-hmm. or to grow by it, or even to protest, to stand up and take a stand, that is a wonderful gift in a situation in which things are not the way they ought to be. Yeah. So opportunity is really the key. When people ask, can you be grateful for everything? No, not for everything, but in every moment.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today at the Gut Eich Priory in St. Gilgen, Austria, with Brother David Stendel-Rost.
And you are a Benedictine. And, I mean, it seems to me that the Psalms, in fact, provide such a rich demonstration of gratitude is woven into almost every psalm in some way, right? But it is held together with an expression of every conceivable human emotion: anger, fury, murderous fury, a sense of injustice and unfairness, and despair and sadness and disappointment. And the gratitude is still there kind of as an insistence, but it's more resilient than the circumstances of the moment, right? It's not a reaction to the circumstances of the moment, but it's an intention that is held. I don't know. I mean,
Well, it's not a reaction to the present moment, because that would be something automatic, but it is a chosen response.
It's a choice, yes.
It's a real response to every moment.
I think when you say not just to what's happened, but to the opportunity that you can discern that has been presented.
And that is why it really secures the kind of joy that we as human beings look for. I always say joy is the happiness that doesn't depend on what happens. And usually we have the idea, well, when something nice happens, then I'm happy, and when something bad happens, of course I'm unhappy. Well, you can be unhappy and yet joyful. We don't think of that, but there is a deep inner peace and joy in the midst of sadness. If we feel our way into it, we know that. For instance, losing a friend, a dear friend, under normal circumstances, not an accident or so, but under normal circumstances, losing our grandparents, losing our parents when they get very old, there's a deep sadness, but there's also a great joy.
A celebration.
A celebration, a joy for all the love that we received and gave. And that kind of joy is what we really want, because happiness is not steady, but joy can be steady. And that's what we really want. We want a happiness that lasts.
Yeah. There's also this, I think, again, to this, you know, this, in the Psalms, there's, you know, this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And then somewhere you, which is, again, kind of a choice to acknowledge that every day, whatever happened yesterday, whatever you're dreading today. But something you quoted, you used some lines of Maya Angelou, which to me is a wonderful paraphrase of that in a way. This is a wonderful day. I've never seen this one before.
Yes.
Which is an orientation to the day, right?
Yes. That uniqueness of every given moment and of every day, to open your eyes and know another day. You know, we can't take it for granted. Mm-hmm. We can't take it for granted. In my youth, we couldn't take it for granted because every night the bombs fell. But if you maintain this attitude, it's just as realistic. There are all sorts of reasons why you couldn't see another day, and you do. And that's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing.
You also talk about gratitude as being absolutely inextricable from the notion of belonging. And I think you're talking about belonging to God and belonging to each other.
Yes.
Say something about that.
I remember the grace that Buddhists pray before a meal starts with the words, innumerable beings brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. And when you put that into practice and look at what's there at your table, on your plate, there is no end to connectedness, you know. In the end, for instance, most people don't think of it, but in the end, we always eat earth. We eat earth, not in an abstract way, in a very concrete way. This humus is what we eat, or crystals. When we eat salt, it's pretty obvious that comes out of the earth. That's earth directly. When we eat vegetables, well, the vegetables were nourished by all the nutrients in the earth, and then now we eat them, or the fruits of these plants. Or if we eat meat or fish, then they were nourished by vegetables and they were nourished by the earth. It always comes back to earth. But that is only one aspect. Most of it was grown, so people had to work on sowing it and harvesting it, packaging it, transporting it. There you have already a couple of thousand people whom you will never see, never know by name, never meet, and yet without them, there wouldn't be anything on your plate, you know. There's this wonderful cartoon where the family sits at Thanksgiving around the table and say, thank you, Jesus. And then in a cloud comes a farm worker whose name happens to be Jesus, like the Mexican farm workers, and says, de nada. So all the farm workers, they have been working on getting this food to us horizontally with our people, our animals, our plants, the earth, and vertically with the great mystery in which we are embedded, which those who use the term correctly call God. It's not somebody up there. It's more personal than it would be if there's somebody up there. It is this tremendous mystery that to which I am as a human being totally directed, totally related to.
Right.
That makes us human. We are related to that which we are called God. That's tremendous reality.
And this inextricability from, or this connection between gratitude, and dependence and interdependence, right? That any complex experience of gratitude would make us aware of that.
Yeah. Well, the main thing is to think it, I think the beginning is the starting point, is to think it through. The moment you speak of independence, I can't just say, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. What is anybody talking about who says I'm independent?
Even from one's enemies.
From every point of view, it is always yes, we belong together. A lived yes, we belong together. So it's a decision. It's something that has more to do with the will than with your emotions or with your thoughts. It is the clear will. I say yes to this embedding, to this connection of all with all. I say yes to it. And when I say yes to it, not just with my mouth, but I actually live that yes.
Yeah. I want to read something. I think one thing, when we talk about something like gratitude or even compassion, it can sound so, again, it's kind of cerebral, kind of like a lovely idea. And obviously we're breaking that down, but I think it comes through very much in your writing, that gratitude is something full-bodied and full-blooded. Here's something you wrote, and literally full-bodied. You said, I'm grateful, allowing my emotions fully to taste and to express the joy I have received, and thus I make it flow back to its source by returning thanks. The whole person is involved when we give thanks from our hearts. The heart is that center in which the human person is one. The intellect recognizes the gift as gift. The will acknowledges my dependence. The emotions, like a sounding board, give fullness to the melody of this experience. And isn't it fascinating that we're living in this moment in the 21st century where actually science is excavating this virtue of gratitude, starting with our bodies, in a way that theology never could? And I know you've been involved in dialogues and with that.
In this sense, science has really discovered spirituality, because at least I define spirituality from the word spirituality. It comes from spiritus, that means life breath, aliveness. Spirituality is aliveness on all levels. It must start with our bodily aliveness. For many people, say the sense of smell is practically non-existent. Mm. If you really are grateful, come alive with your smell. Start smelling, not sightseeing, but smelling. And it is wonderful. It makes you so much more alive. So it starts with the body. But of course, when we say spirituality, we also mean aliveness to interrelationships, aliveness to our confrontation with that great divine mystery with which we are confronted as human beings, and which we can sort of look away from or forget or be dead to. We become alive to it. Mm. And all this coming alive, that is spirituality. And so science has discovered that when people are grateful, they come alive.
Yes, that you can have all these measurable outcomes of well-being. Which you could say aliveness.
And
yes.
Well-being.
Yes.
And it's marvelous. It's just delightful. Mm-hmm. But many people have been waiting until science gives it a little push, and that's all right.
Yeah. Since you talked about spirituality, I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. How do you talk about the distinction, the connection between religion and spirituality? Those two words. I feel like this is something people are very curious about, and we're evolving our understanding of that.
Religion is a difficult word because it really combines two very, very different things. And you're never quite sure which one you're talking about when you say religion. Humans are religious beings, all humans. That means we are open towards this great mystery that some use the word God for, but whether they use it or not, we are all confronted with that great mystery as human beings. And in that sense, religiousness is very close to spirituality. The other thing is out of this religiousness, human beings have at certain times in history created historical and social bodies that are called the religions or the religious traditions. Usually starts with a founder that is a particularly spiritual person, a deeply spiritual person, and then it kind of gets a life of its own. It kind of hardens, it kind of freezes. So I compare these religions that we find in the world with a sort of old volcanoes. At one time they were spewing fire and were a gorgeous spectacle, and now the lava has hardened and nobody would recognize that that was at one point fire. It's all rock. But here and there, somebody comes along, like Mother Teresa or Oscar Romero or Cesar Chavez, whoever, and makes a little crack, and out comes this live fire again. And there you have to do it with the warmth and the fervor of your own heart. Each one of us, we have a certain responsibility if we stand in a particular religion. Mm-hmm. And that has its own great advantages because it gives us forms, it gives us examples, it gives us relatives, all the others that ever belong to it and will belong to it. It's a good, healthy embedding, but it also costs a lot of work, inner work.
You can listen again and share this conversation with Brother David Stendel Rost through our website, onbeing.org. I'm Krista Tippett. On Being continues in a moment.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today I'm with the Benedictine monk, Brother David Stendel Rost. He's a beloved teacher and author on the subject of gratitude. We're exploring his full-blooded, reality-based, redemptive understanding of gratitude in daily life and in the mystical life, which he says belongs to us all.
It's interesting to me. You are part of this tradition of the Benedictine tradition, which is very much embedded in the great enterprise of the Roman Catholic Church and of Christianity. Although monasticism, in its many origins, was monastic traditions or kind of arose as spiritual renewal movements. Right? I mean, kind of what you're saying, you know, a church that had grown institutional and imperial and lost its fire and its spirit. And so monastics, in a sense, have always kind of been rebels in their way. And I find, you know, and I know you must think about this. I mean, here we are in the 21st century and, you know, your TED Talk had 4 million views. People watching a monk talk about gratitude. People are flocking to monasteries on retreat. And it seems to me that monasticism itself, even while it may look established, has always been something kind of on the edges of religion. I'm kind of thinking out loud, but I wonder if this is something you ponder.
I completely agree with what you're saying. I would express it differently, that monasticism was on the edges. In some respects, it was on the edges of the institution. That's what you mean.
Yes, that's what I mean.
But as far as the tradition is concerned, it was at the very heart.
Driving to the core.
At the very core.
Yes, yes.
Because the core of every religion is the religion of the heart, and that is the monastic life.
Yeah.
Of course, as an institution, and monasteries are also institutions, it also again and again hardens and becomes decadent, has to be renewed. But as an idea, the monastic life, all the different monasteries are a network of networks. Every monastery is a little network of monks and all the ones that belong to it. It's interesting, for instance, that today when the number of monks in most monasteries, not everywhere, in other parts of the world, like in Africa and in Southeast Asia, Benedictine monasteries are growing.
Right. And they have many young people entering.
Yeah, growing. But in the West, it's getting smaller and smaller as far as monks are concerned. But so many more lay people, as oblates, as we call them, mm-hmm. as extended family members, that the monasteries, if you count the oblates, are bigger now than they were before. Yeah. And for these lay people who live their own lives every day, but in the spirit somehow of monastic life, because there's mm-hmm. a monk in each of us, For them, this is really a great help in their lives and a help also to live gratefully. So, I think the monasteries have a real special vocation in our time.
A renewed vocation. It's a vocation that has evolved, kind of.
Yes, it has evolved.
Because
this power pyramid that has characterized our society, our whole civilization from the very beginning, mm-hmm. for 5,000 years now, this pyramid of power, where even all our admirable culture and music and inventions and sciences is all bought at the price of oppression and exploitation. Mm-hmm. This is very sad, but mm-hmm. this power pyramid is in process of collapsing. That's what's happening in our times. Mm-hmm. And if you speak to people who are close to the top, and I have been privileged to speak to people pretty high up in politics, in economy, in science, in all the different fields, medicine and so forth, and everybody says, we have come to the end of the rope. Things are breaking down. People who really have an insight. Mm-hmm. Because this pyramid has no future.
The form and the structure of how we did power and created.
It has to be replaced by network.
Yes.
And everybody knows that. Yes. And every group, the monks are by no means the only ones. There are many, many communes and other groups out there that live a network of friends, a network of women who serve.
Yeah.
These networks, they are the future. Raimundo Panica, probably came across him, one of the great minds of the 20th century, said, the future will not be a new big tower of power. Our hope in the future is the hope into well-trodden paths from house to house. That is the image that holds a lot of promise for our future.
Mm. Mm. I was looking at a dialogue you had with Zen Roshi. And let's say you've been for a long time, even in the 60s, I mean, Thomas Merton became very well known for his dialogue with Buddhist monastics, and you've also been part of that all this time, and I guess we're with Thomas Merton in that great adventure back then when it was so new. And you lived through a moment in the early 20th century, which arguably, as bad as we may feel it is now, was so much more horrendous in terms of millions of people dying and global crises, you know, people starving. You know, you talked about the refugee crisis then. There were literally people dying by the side of the road, and you were involved in that. But you said something in this dialogue that we have had many thousands of crises in our history, but this world finds itself not only in a crisis, but on the brink of self-annihilation, that the stakes are higher somehow now. And I wonder if you would talk about that, but also talk about how in this kind of moment, you know, how is it even reasonable or how is it vital to talk about, to use language like gratitude and gratefulness? Like, how is that a resource for us? How does it make sense in this moment?
Yes. Well, when we look at things like global warming or the destruction of the environment or this uncontrollable violence that's breaking out here and there and can't be sort of, you can't touch it, you can't grab it. That is really, I think that justifies us to say we are at the brink of self-annihilation. However, we must acknowledge our anxiety about it. We must acknowledge our anxiety, but we must not fear. And gratefulness is a
great... We have to acknowledge our anxiety, but we must not fear.
Not fear. There is a great difference. Mm-hmm. See, anxiety or anxious, being anxious, this word comes from a root that means narrowness and choking the original anxiety is our birth anxiety. See, we all come into this world through this very uncomfortable process of being born, unless you happen to be a cesarean baby. It's really a life and death struggle mm-hmm. for both the mother and the child. And that is the prototype of anxiety. At that time, we do it fearlessly because fear is the resistance against this anxiety. Okay. See? If you go with it, it brings you into birth. If you resist it, you die in the womb or your mother dies.
So anxiety is not just an understandable but a reasonable response to a lot of human experience.
It's a reasonable response, and we ought to acknowledge it mm-hmm. and affirm it mm-hmm. because to deny our mm-hmm. anxiety mm-hmm. is another form of resisting
right.
it.
Right, and so that is reasonable, but the fear is actually that moment of resisting, and it's a completely
destroying.
Different move, and it takes us, our bodies, our minds, in a completely different direction.
Destroys it, yeah. And that is why we can look back at our life, not only at our birth, but at all other spots where we got into a really tight spot and suffered anxiety. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is not optional in life. It's part mm-hmm. of life. Mm-hmm. We come into life through mm-hmm. anxiety. And we look at it and remember it and say to ourselves, we made it. We got through it. We made it. In fact, the worst anxieties and the worst tight spots in our life, often years later when you look back at them, reveal themselves as the beginning of something completely new, new life. Mm-hmm. And that can teach us. And that can give us courage also now that we think about it in looking forward and saying, yes, this is a tight spot. It's about as tight spot as the world has ever been in, or at least humankind. But if we go with it, and that will be grateful living, if we go with it, it will be a new birth. And that is trust in life. And this going with it means you look, what is the opportunity?
So, and I think for you, what you're getting at is for you, gratitude is as much about being present to the moment, but it's also to you about seeing the opportunity in the moment beyond
the
current circumstances.
And availing yourself of the opportunity.
Okay. So it's a very active.
Yeah.
It's very active.
Is very difficult because anxiety has a way of paralyzing us. Mm-hmm. You see? Mm-hmm. But What really paralyzes us is fear. It's not the anxiety, it's the fear, because it resists. Yeah. The moment we give up the resistance, and so everything hinges on this trust in life, trust. And with this trust, with this faith, we can go into that anxiety and say, it's terrible, it feels awful, but I trust that it is just another birth into a greater fullness.
You've said that God is a direction rather than a something.
A direction.
Yes.
Yes. But not an impersonal direction, you see. Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful line by Rilke in which he prays to God. You know German, so I say it first in German.
And I love Rilke, as you do. Yeah, so say it in German, please do.
He says, ich gehe doch immer auf dich zu mit meinem ganzen Gehen, denn wer bin ich und wer bist du, wenn wir uns nicht verstehen? Mm-hmm. So he says, with every step I do, I go towards you, because who am I and who are you if we don't understand one another? See, that is spoken to that great mystery. But when I say mystery, I mean not something vague. I mean something very clear.
Well, it gets us back to the sense of belonging. That belonging at the core of...
It's right in there. Yes, I go to you. See, the moment a human being says, I, at that moment I have posited a you. That means I'm saying I because I'm related to a you, that mysterious you that is always here. And in that sense, this mystery is not something impersonal.
It's relational.
It's a relation. Ultimately, everything boils down to relation.
You also said, I found this such an interesting, mysticism is the experience of limitless belonging.
Yes.
That mysticism, because again, I think that's a word, you use the word mysticism in Western culture, and people might think of something very abstract, you know, and very elite.
No, I believe that every one of us is a mystic, because we have this experience of belonging once in a while, out of a blue. This women often say when they give birth to a child, they have it. Or when we fall in love, we have this sense of belonging. Or sometimes without any particular reason, suddenly out in nature, you feel one with everything. And every human being has this. But what we call the great mystics, they let this experience determine and shape every moment of their lives. They never forgot it. And we humans, the rest of us, tend to forget it. We just forget it. Mm-hmm. But if we keep it in mind, then we are really related to that great mystery, and then we can find joy in it.
Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today at the Gut Eich Priory in St. Gilgen, Austria, with Brother David Stendel-Rost. It is a very audacious thing that you say, that everyone can be called to be a mystic. That mysticism is not for you the domain of professionals, that mysticism is something that is the birthright human being.
The mystic is not a special human being. Every human being is a special kind of mystic. And I never was around that particular kind of mystic that you can be, because you're unique. Never has anybody brought the talents and also the shortcomings that also belongs to it. Mm-hmm. And that goes very closely together with what I mean when I say mystery. It's not something mysterious. When I say this great mystery, this divine mystery that we are confronted with and in mysticism experience, that is something that we cannot grasp. You see, we cannot put it in words. We cannot imagine it in an image. We cannot put it in a concept. We cannot grasp it, but we can understand it. There's a great difference between grasping and understanding. Mm-hmm. And you understand it by being grasped. But it does something to you. And many people experience that on a different level with music.
Yes, yes.
You understand music, but you can't grasp music. You can't...
And you can't really talk about it.
You can't even talk about it because you have no words and concepts. But you can understand it when you allow it to take hold of you, when you give yourself to the music. And that great mystery with... you might call it life or God or whatever, that great mystery with which all human beings are always confronted, that we can also not grasp, obviously, but we can understand by allowing it to do something to us. Mm. And that openness can be totally silent. Silent openness is a wonderful form of prayer.
Mm. Hmm. One of the ways you talk about prayer, also in the context of gratitude, as whatever lifts your heart, right? That's a way to start talking about the experience of prayer.
Yes. And what we experience when we are grateful is that something lifts up our heart, that joy that is gratitude, and that joy is prayer because it lifts up our heart.
Yeah.
Whatever lifts up our heart. And we are made for that.
Yeah. And you said if it's fishing that lifts up your heart, then fishing is your prayer.
Yeah.
Or part of your prayer. I know I have to finish. I guess I just maybe finally, you know, you studied psychology. And I sense that you're very aware of how it's instinctive for us to question gratitude. Maybe this is true in Western culture, right? To question its appropriateness or its purity, and also to suspect the motives of others. We get very complicated when we walk into this territory of gratitude and to withhold gratitude from others. You speak about having the courage to let ourselves down into the depth which gratitude opens up. And I wonder if you would just say a little bit more about that and maybe how that has come to you, like how you have experienced letting yourself down into that depth.
Yes, when I speak of depth and so forth, those are all only images. Poetic images, one must not...
But it's very magnetic language, I think.
Yeah, well, poetic language has more power than most other languages.
Yeah.
So you want me to be personal. When I'm confronted with something, for instance, of which I have to say, heavens, for this I can't be grateful, obviously, and where do I find the opportunity in this? That's all too glib, and I have to eat my own words.
Yeah.
Then I let go of all this, of all this thought and all this, and I just try to sit quietly. It's like you take this whole package of things that you don't particularly like to deal with, and you throw them in a lake, and they go down and go down and go down. And then you just quiet yourself. And when you get sufficiently quiet, that may take long or it may not take very long, and it may not be in one sitting, it may take days or weeks. But when you got sufficiently quiet, then without you having to figure something out, some answer emerges. That's the best I can do to express it. But we find somehow the way through. This throwing it into the lake is like no resistance. You see, don't give
any reason. You're letting rid of that fear, that impulse of fear.
Just accept it. This courage, this quiet holding, and it leads to a new birth. I can't prove it, but I can encourage you to try it. Everybody try it. And I think we will find it too.
Okay. I think that people feel that we're living in a very dark time. What are you grateful for right now in the world? What gives you hope? Where does your gratitude find an abundant place to land?
Well, one thing I have already said that's on a larger scale, looking back and seeing that all the most difficult experiences always lead to something new and even something better.
Even culturally, even geopolitically.
On every level. Mm-hmm. But in order to keep us going, it is enough to be grateful for the next breath, because it's not to be taken for granted that I can take another breath. And if I think of the millions of people who have breathing difficulties, and here I can breathe, just to remember that, just be grateful for the next breath.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's been really, really wonderful to be here.
Brother David Stendel-Rost is the founder and senior advisor for A Network for Grateful Living. His books include Gratefulness, A Listening Heart, and more recently, a new autobiography, I Am Through You, So I. And if you want more gratitude, you'll find audio, visual, and written resources at Brother David's website, gratefulness.org. On Being is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Mariah Helgeson,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Malka Fenavesi,
Aaron Farrell,
Jill Ganas,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
and Bettina Davis.
We were able to go to Austria to visit Brother David through a special gift from the John Templeton Foundation. Special thanks this week also to Margaret Wakely, Christy Nelson, Brother Thomas Hessler, and the rest of the staff at Gut Eich Priory in St. Gilgen, Austria. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice you hear singing our final credits in each show is hip-hop artist Lizzo. On Being was created at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the John Templeton Foundation, the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. The Henry Luce Foundation, in support of public theology reimagined. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and is a Krista Tippett public production.